Nimrud sat brooding on his great black throne, draped over it like a wind-tossed rag. Incensed at Prince Jaspin's bumbling ineffectiveness, he nevertheless grudgingly considered that the chance encounter of Théoduin Pigeon had brought about an even better possibility than he had planned, the opportunity of defeating that meddlesome hermit, that bone in his throat, Durwin, once and for all. As he mulled over these recent developments, a new plan began to take shape. He called for his servants to bring him the keys, which they did, as they carried out all his orders, with stumbling haste, lest they displease their perverse lord.
Tell Yurik I will see him in the dungeon at once.
Nimrud snatched the large ring from the servant's trembling hand and flew like a bat from the throne. In a further part of the dungeon, Yurik, a man almost as depraved as his keeper, found Nimrud unlocking the door to a special cell.
Allow me to do that for you, master.
Nimrud stepped into the darkened room.
Incendious!
Fire leapt from his fingers to a torch sitting in its iron holder on the wall. He handed the torch to Yurik and indicated that he was to lead the way. Through the chamber and a door at the opposite end, they went. The second door opened onto a narrow hall lined with cells. They hurried past these cells and came to the end of the passage, which terminated in a narrow flight of stone steps twisting down into a black vault below. The two entered the vault.
Incendious Varum!
Suddenly, all the torches around the room flashed to life. There, in the guttering glare of the torches, lay nine massive stone tables in rows of three. Six of the tables were occupied with the prostrate forms of six mighty knights bedecked in gleaming armor, with swords clutched over their chests and their shields across their loins. Each one appeared composed and serene, only sleeping, in an instant to join the call to arms. But their flesh bore the ashen tint of dead men's flesh, and their eyes were sunken like dead men's eyes.
Death's Legion! Look on it, Yurik. It is terrible, is it not? Soon it will be complete, and I will give the signal, and these, my army, will arise. With them, I will conquer the world. Who can stand against such as these, the boldest knights the world has ever seen?
Nimrud moved among the slabs.
Heselrid, Vorgil, Junius, Kennet, Jeffrick, Lewin.
Yurik indicated the three empty biers.
Who will occupy these places to complete the number?
One is Ferransard. Who would be here now if not for Pigeon and his men? But I have given them another chance. They will bring him now by sea. The other is for King Escavar, who shall be commander of my legion. Very soon now, he will join his new regiment. His will is strong. He lingers yet. But my will is stronger, and he shall be mine ere long. Look how still they sleep. Even death does not diminish them.
The necromancer's eyes glittered with excitement as he beheld his handiwork.
And who is the last slab for, Great One?
Yurik fully enjoyed his participation in the Black Arts, as much as did Nimrud.
The last, I feared, would have to remain empty. The great knight Marsan died in the petty war against Gore, and the ignorant barbarians burned his body. But now, it appears I shall not lack a full complement of warriors to lead my soldiers into battle. Thedo, that troublesome renegade, will be joining us at last. He will no doubt thank me for the opportunity to serve his king in death as he once served him on the battlefield in life.
How will this be accomplished?
Did I not tell you? The gods decree that I am indeed fortunate. Pigeon found him wandering the Wharf of Bestu, where they await the sailing season. It seems the foolish knight wishes passage for himself and his companions to Karsh. They would come here! Since they are so eager to die, I will not disappoint them. Oh, Biggin will deliver them to their destination, all right. And with a courtesy they do not expect.
Yorick's face glimmered in the dim torchlight. His eyes rolled up into his head ecstatically as he contemplated his foul lord's intricate machinations.
Oh, you shall rule the world, Nimrod.
The harbor of Bestu remained wrapped in rain and fog for several long and vacant days. Then, on a quiet afternoon of damp, dripping drizzle, the sun broke through in a sudden burst of beaming brilliance, and all the sailors abiding in the inns and taverns of the town streamed down to the quay with their scant belongings, stuffed into rucksacks and canvas bags. They came as if on signal. That night they would sleep aboard their vessels and sail with the dawn. When the rising sun was merely a dull promise on the eastern horizon, Thedo and the others made their way down to the docks and boarded the ferry with a few other passengers to be delivered to various ships lying at anchor in the harbor. Ships were already streaming toward the pinched opening of the harbor to be the first to take to the open seas. As they pulled further into the harbor, the humped back of Tildene rose in the thin spring mist which hung over Bestu like a gossamer cloud. Gulls worked the air with their slender wings and complained of the activity in their harbor as they hovered and dived among the ships. Tren stood in the front of the boat, directing the rowers to their ship, and Thedo sat in the rear, pensively watching the land recede slowly behind them.
You appear wistful, brave knight. Tell us, what could trouble your mind on a morning such as this? We are on our way at last.
I slept ill last night, m'lady. A fearful dream came over me as I tossed on my bed. I awoke sweating and cold, but of the dream I remember nothing. It vanished as yonder mist will disappear when the morning sun touches it. But the feeling of doom lingers, though the dream has departed.
Derwin listened to his friend, nodding and rubbing his chin with his hand.
Yes, I too felt ill at ease last night. I take it to be a confirmation of our quest. Sometimes we must enter the course by the least likely gate. God has his own way. Often mysterious and always, always unpredictable.
Well, we go and none will stop us. Come what may, the gods will not find us sitting idly by. It is good to be moving again.
I only hope we may be in time.
Alenia turned her lovely face away for a moment and was silent.
Yes, Jaspin and the regents will convene their council soon, I think. His crown is bought many times over ere now, if I know him at all.
Time will not be hurried. We can go only as fast as we may. I will pray to the god that our purpose will not be thwarted. He is a god of righteousness and loves justice. He will not see us fail.
Well said, holy hermit. I am always forgetting the god you serve is of a different stripe than the gods of old. But I prefer to trust to my own arm for righteousness and the point of my sword for justice.
Arms lose their strength and swords their edge. Then it is good to remember whence came your strength, and who holds a sword that is never dull.
Holy hermit, tell me about your god. He seems to be far different from the capricious immortals our people have long worshipped. May I learn of him, do you think?
Why, of course, my lady. He turns away none who come to him, and it would honor me to instruct one as wise and lovely as you. This gives a purpose to the empty hours of our voyage.
As these last words were spoken, the rowboat bumped against the side of Captain Piggin's ship.
Passengers!
Tren grasped for the rope that dangled from the taffrail. A squinting face appeared over the rail. The man regarded them closely and disappeared again. A rope ladder dropped over the side of the ship, which was quickly secured by the rowers. Tren clambered up the ladder and reached a hand down to the others. When they had all assembled on the deck, Piggin came up.
Everyone aboard! Yes, well, excuse me. I did not know we would have the pleasure of a lady on our journey. I am honored. This way, I will show you to your quarters.
As Piggin herded his passengers before him, he gave the signal for the crew to cast off. Neither Thedo nor Tren saw the signal, nor did they see several crew members skulking along behind them, toting belaying pins in their thick fists.
The Grey Gull is a small ship, but a tight one. I think you'll find your accommodations adequate.
Piggin indicated a narrow door leading to stairs descending to the ship's hold.
Are there no other passengers?
No, we seldom take passengers. But we have made an exception for you, my lords.
Piggin opened the door and ushered them down the stairs. No sooner had Thedo, deemed the last of the party to enter the hold, reached the bottom step, than did Piggin throw the door shut.
Enjoy your voyage, my lord!
Open this door, you scoundrel! In the name of the king, open, I say!
Well, we are in it now. It's my fault. I should have listened to the counsel of our good warder, Tren.
Nay, do not blame yourself. 'Tis true I had a boding of ill, but let us consider what best to do now.
What monster lurks hereabout? Listen!
It is no monster. It is a man, and he is hurt.
Feeling her way in the dark hold, lit only by a few lattice-covered hatches cut in the center of the deck overhead, Polinia moved slowly around the musty kegs, followed closely by the others. There, in the dim gray light, she saw the form of a man stretched out upon a pile of dirty rags and ropes. His head was bandaged, and upon perceiving his fellow prisoners, the man slumped back on his filthy bed in a swoon. Something about the unconscious form struck the queen.
I know this man.
Alenia took the bandaged head in her hands and peered intently into the insensible face. Her eyes grew wide in recognition.
Can it be?
Who is it, my lady? Do you recognize him?
Look!
Tren knelt down beside her. The ship, already underway, dipped and turned, and for a moment, the feeble light from an overhead hatch fell full upon the man's face.
It is Ronsard!
It is Ronsard! By the gods, it is!
You stand there blinking, young sir. Is there something your heart would say, but your tongue cannot?
Quentin, suspended by the feeling that he had once stood in the very spot, talking to this venerable little man, could only stare in wonder. But the feeling passed like a cloud sweeping before the sun, and Quentin came to himself again.
I had the feeling that I've been here before. That I know you.
The Kuratak elder smiled knowingly and nodded.
Perhaps you have. All the more reason I should treat my guest with honor.
Yosef turned and led the way between the towering shelves.
These are my life.
Yosef indicated row upon row of books with his raised palm. He went on to describe the work going on in the enormous library. Quentin followed in rapt attention, fascinated by all he saw, and haunted by the lingering feeling that he belonged here, that somehow he had come home. Presently, their tour led them to a row of copy desks, where Kuratak scholars were hard at work over manuscripts, making notes and translating. Yosef made his way along the desks. Then he reached a door which stood ajar, and Quentin entered Yesef's own workroom. The small room was sparely furnished, with a desk piled high with scrolls and a table straining under the weight of still more books. Generous light poured into the room from a round skylight overhead. Two fragile-looking chairs faced each other, and Yosef took one and waved Quentin to the other.
Now then, Molina tells me you have questions which only I can answer. I will try.
For a moment, Quentin had quite forgotten his questions, but upon recollection, they came back to him, if somewhat reduced in importance by the things he had seen around him. Quentin explained to Yosef, who listened patiently, about the disagreement between Thedo and Derwin, and Thedo's reluctance to come to Dekra.
Though I could see no reason for fear, surely there is only good here, unless the danger lay not in the destination, but in the reason for coming.
Your mind is quick. Yes, I could not have put it better myself. There is no danger here. The stories, superstitious prattle, made up to scare the children. Though I admit we do not discourage them. Our work is very important. It is best that the world stays far away and troubles us only rarely. But that is not why Thedo did not want to come, or rather did not wish Derwin to come. Dekra is a place of power, one of the last remaining on the earth. Derwin knows this, as does Thedo. You little know your hermit friend, a man of amazing talents. He came to us as high priest of the Temple of Ariel. On a pilgrimage he was, seeking to further his quest for knowledge. He believed at that time that knowledge alone could transform a man, make him immortal, exalt him to the status of the gods. Here he found how far wrong he was. It would have crushed a lesser man, but not him. He grew from strength to strength, discarding all his previous beliefs as fast as he could embrace his new ones. In 3 years' time, he learned all that we had to teach. He went back to the temple and renounced his position and his faith. They nearly killed him, would have, but for the scandal. Derwin returned to us then, but only for a short time, though we begged him to stay and join us in our work. But he had greater things to do. The god revealed that to him. You see, he had only come back to divest himself of all his earthly power. As high priest, he had studied long the magic of sorcerers, the wizard's art, and he had become keenly adept. But he saw that for what it was, the way of death. He put off his power, here, where he knew no one would misuse it. As it happened, when Nimrud was discovered to have risen against the king and his kingdom, Derwin thought to come here to retrieve his power, to take it up again in this good cause. He proposed to face Nimrud himself, alone. That was not to be.
The elder's word sank slowly in.
Then what will become of them? They go to meet the enemy unarmed.
They go. Unarmed they may be, but not unguarded. We could not allow our honorable friend to take such a terrible burden upon himself. It would destroy him. Thedo understood that, although imperfectly. He knew that coming here would very likely mean the death of Derwin.
But he changed his mind. Why?
He weakened in the face of the threat posed by the Harriers and Derwin's insistence. Still, that mattered but little. We did not allow them to carry out their plan.
The power has been put off. It is here, and here it will stay. How could you let them go?
Quentin knew nothing of Nimrud, only that everyone around him seemed to tremble at the name. The sorcerer appeared to be the cause of all the troubles besetting the land. Quentin had not experienced the evil of the Black Wizard firsthand. He had been spared that. But he had formed a picture in his mind of something grotesque and twisted in its terrible hate. Less a man than a maleficent monster. It was the monster Nimrud his friends now quested, unarmed by the power which Derwin might have commanded.
How could you let them go?
How could we prevent them from going?
What will happen now? They cannot stand against Nimrud alone.
Your friends are not alone. The god goes with them.
Yesef said it so simply, so trustingly, that Quentin wanted desperately to believe him. But his own doubts, and all that he had seen in the temple, stole away his seed of belief before it could take root. His face fell in misery.
The gods care little for the affairs of men. Our lives mean nothing to them.
You are right, and yet you are far from the truth. The Most High God is one. The gods of earth and sky are but the chaff blown before the mighty wind of his coming. They cannot stand in his presence, and even now their power grows weak.
But what makes this nameless god different from all the others?
He cares.
Again, Quentin wanted desperately to believe for the sake of his friends. But the years of temple training, all his earlier beliefs, rushed upon him and extinguished any spark of hope that what Yesef said might be true.
I wish I could believe you.
Do not fear for your friends. The god holds them in the palm of his hand.
They will be destroyed!
They may be killed, but not destroyed. There are worse things than death, though I would not expect you to know about them. It would be worse for Derwin to take up again the power which he laid down years ago. That would destroy him in the end. He would become the same as Nimrud. He would become the very thing he hated. That would be worse than honorable death. Besides, do you think your presence with them would sway the balance very much?
Quentin's head fell to his chest. His cheeks burned with shame.
Who am I to make a difference? I am no one. No one at all.
You feel things deeply, Quentin. You are young, impetuous. Your heart speaks before your head, but it will not always be so.
But is there nothing I can do to help them?
Quentin felt helpless and cast aside. Useless baggage.
Does it mean that much to you?
Quentin nodded in silence. His eyes sought Yasef's for some sign that the old man would help him find a way.
I see. The god's ways are mysterious indeed. I will puzzle on this and bring it before our council of elders. There are those among us who discern more clearly than I how the god's hand moves through time and men's lives. We will seek their counsel.
Quentin's eyes brightened at the prospect, and hope revived in his heart. As he left Yasef to his work, he felt as if a great burden had been lifted from him. He did not know what to make of the feeling.
Quentin, there is more to you than meets the eye. I knew that the moment you opened your mouth to speak. When all this is over, promise me you will come back again and sit at my feet. There is much I would teach you.
Jaspin called his hirelings together in the great hall of Castle Urlet. The sun was well up and warming the land to a fresh and early spring. The prince was growing more restive with each passing day, now sweetly polite and even jovial in company. The tight little lines around his mouth told those who knew him best that the prince was deeply troubled.
I have decided that the Council of Regents must be held within a fortnight.
Jaspin spoke to his assembled knights and nobles. Many had taken their leave of Urlet Fields to attend their own concerns, but many still remained at the prince's pleasure.
Sire, we must protest this alteration.
Lord Naylor and his neighbor Lord Holban alone dared to confront the prince openly. Naylor himself, chief regent of the Council of Regents, was no great friend of Jaspin. Others in the group demonstrated their agreement with Lord Naylor by nodding and nudging one another.
After all these years, the Council will accomplish its duty in good time and without undignified haste. I see no reason to depart from our commission now.
The prince rankled at this challenge to his ambition.
What I propose shall be done. And you, my lord, shall see that it is done according to my wishes.
Jaspin fixed Naylor with an icy glare, and then looked around at each of the others individually, defying them to challenge him.
And you shall have the letters drawn up and dispatched to all the members not in attendance here, that we shall hold council here in Urlet, not in Paget.
And if I refuse your suggestions?
The prince little knew or cared that he was making the situation harder for himself by bullying the chief counselor of the regents. But Jaspin was a man whose mind seized upon a thing like a mongrel with a meaty bone and would not be put off.
Refusal would be construed as failure of your office. You could be replaced.
Some who looked on, and who would have happily pledged their support of Prince Jaspin if allowed to do so with a show of free will, were now uneasy at the thought of electing him at his own direction, for so they surmised his plans. They were appalled at the idea of naming him king in his own castle, and not, as tradition dictated, in the Hall of Paget. Jaspin only sought to hasten the appointed meeting, and, since as the object of the meeting he would not be allowed to attend the council himself, he thought that by simply moving the designated meeting place to his own castle, he would then know the result that much sooner, and save himself a ride to Paget, a journey of several days. His idea, however, was a solidly unpopular one, and if not for Lord Naylor's challenge, Jaspin would have been persuaded by a cooler head such as Antescu's to abandon his scheme. But the matter had proceeded too far. Jaspin would have it no other way. A hasty conference proceeded between Holban and the chief regent.
I will do as you bid, my lord, but you may regret having pressed your way in this matter.
Lord Naylor turned and crossed the room under Jaspin's dark look.
By your leave.
He walked out of the hall. In 4 days at sea, the captives had been fed twice, a ration of coarse bread. But as they had access to all the water aboard ship, they lacked nothing for their thirst. Queen Alenia had been able to nurse Ronsard back to his senses. With her kind ministrations and the help of Derwin's healing power, the knight swore he felt better by the hour. Alenia insisted he remain reposed on his bed, although, cheered by the nearness of his friends, Ronsard largely ignored her pleas. They had much to talk about, and he much to tell.
It gives me no pleasure to say it, my lady, but I fear for the king. Nimrud is a crafty snake. His plots are beyond reckoning. However, we may be certain there is mortal danger for any within his grasp.
He has induced Prince Jaspin, though little enough encouragement was needed. And I have heard it voiced far and wide that Nimrud raises an army. Though who or what would fight for him, I cannot but wonder. In Elsinore, there are rumors of a legion of the dead.
By Ulfing, no! Oh, it is too horrible to contemplate.
Has he the power to do such things?
He has, and we have not the means to stop him of ourselves.
We will find a way. Nimrud will be stopped. My life is my pledge.
Would that my arm had the strength to hold my sword.
Nay, brave sir. Rest and allow vigor to return.
Alas, though I could wield 10 swords, I have none in this time of need.
Soon, too soon, I fear, there will be no lack of blades, but of hands to hold them. You will have your chance, Ronsard. Only content yourself till then and pray your strength recovers.
Derwin peered deeply into Ronsard's clouded eyes. The knight shook his head, and his eyelids fluttered weakly. He lay his head back and slipped off to sleep moments later.
Would that I had such power over our enemies as I have over the wounds of brave knights.
Tren looked at the hermit with wide eyes full of awe.
There is power enough, I'll warrant, for many purposes. Perhaps you could charm this Nimrud to sleep as you did Ronsard just now.
Would that I could, but no. The power that remains in me is of a healing kind, though it may be turned for other purposes in time of need. Were I to think of harming someone, even the evil Nimrud, this last remnant of my power would desert me instantly. It is a law of this healing power to be used ever thus. But what may be done with drafts and potions and the mixing of rare earths, that I may still do. Oh, I have been so slow. Gather round quickly. I have a plan.
The captives talked together for a long while, quietly discussing the beginnings of their plan.
I trust my fine passengers are enjoying their trip.
Captain Piggin's portly form could now be discerned, descending the steep stairs, followed by two of his ruffians.
Give them their food!
By Zoral!
Tren jumped to his feet. The guard's long knife flashed in his hand in an instant.
Make no threats you care not to die by! My men are less civilized than I. They killed to pass the time.
What do you want, pirate?
Only to tell you to enjoy your final hours. We reach our destination in 2 days hence.
Piggin waved his hand, and the sailor carrying the food set down an iron pot and tossed a couple of loaves onto the filthy floor of the hold. Piggin turned to leave.
Enjoy your meal!
Today, mark them well, they'll be our last.
The last light of day splashed crimson into the sky and tinted the edge of lingering clouds violet and blue. Quentin walked easily, though nervously, between Molina and Toli. Ahead of them loomed the graceful silhouette of the Uruga Temple. Molina was dressed in a long flowing robe of white, edged in silver, and her gray hair was pulled back straight to hang down her back. Quentin gazed upon her as he walked, thinking that something of the woman she must have been was revived in her this night. She appeared much younger than her years, her skin smoothed, the wrinkles eased with a radiance he had never seen in her countenance.
Yes, it is Molina and no other.
Her eyes twinkled brightly as they approached an avenue of torches leading to the temple entrance.
You are beautiful tonight, Molina.
You say that now because you have not met our young women.
Quentin realized with a wince that he would not be meeting any young women at all. He and Toli had made plans to leave in the morning. His gaze slid from Molina's laughing mouth to Toli's deep-set dark eyes. He, like Quentin, was dressed in a sky-blue mantle, which covered a white tunic embroidered with silver at the neck. Toli looked like a Pelagian prince with his brown skin and gleaming black hair. For all the trouble they had faced in getting him to give up his rough skins, Toli appeared quite used to such finery. Quentin, though, was too nervous to enjoy himself, except in fleeting moments when he forgot what was about to happen. for he was to be presented in a special temple service given in his honor. Quentin was to receive a special gift, as Yesif had explained it. He was to receive the blessing of the Araga. What that might be, Quentin could only guess.
Here you are.
Quentin did not see Yesif at first. He was gazing up at the sweeping lines of the temple's narrow, finger-thin central tower. People, dressed in the same simple elegance as Melina and Yesif, streamed into the temple.
Follow me. I will lead us to our places.
Quentin obeyed mutely. Yesif led them along quickly. Quentin could see through the spaces between the great hanging tapestries they passed. The sanctuary of the temple was already mostly filled with worshippers. They moved around the semicircular auditorium and arrived at a side entrance where three men in long white robes waited with a half dozen young men carrying large candlesticks of burnished gold. One of the priests, for so Quentin took them, held out a white robe for Yesif, who slipped it on over his other garments.
Now, we are ready. Quentin, you follow me and do as I instructed you earlier. Molina, you and Toli may take your places in the front row. You may watch from there.
The three priests, or elders, turned and formed a single line. Yesif stepped into file behind them, and Quentin behind him. The firebearers stood on either side of them, forming an impressive procession. Then they were moving down a wide aisle toward a raised platform, behind which hung a great golden tapestry, which glittered bright as the sun in the light of hundreds of candles. There were seats arranged in a semicircle on the platform behind a large stone altar. Upon reaching the final step, the elders went to their seats, and the firebearers placed their candles in receptacles around the altar. Yesif took a seat near the center of the circle, and Quentin sat at his right hand.
Listen carefully, and do as I say. There will be an invocation calling of the one to hear our prayers. Then, Elder Thamu will deliver a short message to our people. When that is done, it will be our turn. We will enter into the holy place. I will lead, you will follow.
Quentin nodded his understanding. One of the elders ascended to the device Quentin had taken for an altar. It was a large stone cube set in the center of the platform, with steps at the rear, allowing the speaker to climb to the top. Around it, in a circle, burned the candles placed by the firebearers.
Mighty Paran Nimparano, King of Kings, you who ever hear our prayers, hear us now.
The invocation continued, and to Quentin it seemed somewhat similar, and yet very different, from the invocations he had heard in the temple at Naramore. Similar in the style of speech and the words used, but very different in the way in which it was delivered. There was no fear, no self-conscious or ostentatious display of humility. The elder spoke simply and with assurance that his voice was heard by the god, as it was heard by the hundreds who filled the sanctuary. Quentin shifted nervously in his chair, a little unnerved by the idea that the god was actually listening to them, watching them. Quentin imagined that he could actually feel the god's presence, and then surprised himself when a real surge of emotion welled up within him in response to his imaginings. He puzzled on these things as the ceremony moved along its determined course.
So speaks the god, and so his flock shall listen.
At Yesif's example, Quentin started to his feet. As the words of Elder Themu's message died away in the vast hall, Quentin had daydreamed through the entire speech. It seemed like only moments since he had been seated, and yet he had a vague recollection that there had been more singing and the reading of the sacred text. But it all ran together in his mind as one brief event. Now he was standing and moving toward the stone with Yesif.
My good friends!
Quentin looked out at the hundreds of bright eyes glittering in the light of the candles. All he saw were the eyes.
We have come tonight to confer upon this young man, a sojourner among us, the blessing of the Araga.
Nods of approval rippled through the auditorium.
Attend us now with your prayers.
Yesif signaled the firebearers who came forward, each one carrying a candle in a shallow bowl. The firebearers filed to the rear of the platform, followed by Yesif and Quentin, and then the remaining elders. As they approached the wonderful golden tapestry, two of the firebearers stepped up and drew the tapestry aside. But Quentin saw a narrow doorway. Yesif entered the doorway, darkened but for the flickering glow of the candles, and they passed through a short corridor and into an inner chamber. The chamber was much like the inside of a tomb. Bare, cut out of smooth stone, with a stone ledge running the length of the further wall. No symbols or ornaments were to be seen, as the firebearers silently began placing their candles about the room. Quentin saw at one end of the oblong room a small fountain playing peacefully in a hollow bowl set in the floor. The elders took their places along the stone ledge, and Yesef drew Quentin toward the fountain.
Kneel, Quentin.
Quentin knelt down before the fountain and felt the smooth stone cool against his legs.
This is a place of power, the center of the Auriga's devotion. For in this room, each young Auriga received a blessing when he came of age. They received many blessings throughout life, but this was a special one, delivered not by the elder or priest, but by Wist Aurin, the Most High God himself. This special blessing they carried throughout life and became a part of their life. They did not earn it, nor did it require a ritual of purification or obedience. The blessing is the gift of the god. All that is required is a true heart and a desire to receive it. Now, then, is there any reason why you should not receive the blessing of the Auriga?
Quentin, his eyes focused on the fountain while Yesef had been speaking, turned to look into the elder's kindly eyes.
No. It is my desire to receive the blessing.
Then so be it.
Yesef raised his hands above his head.
Most High God, here is one who would be your follower. Speak to him now, and out of your wisdom and truth, give him your blessing.
Yesef stooped to the fountain and cupped his hands in the water.
Drink.
Quentin took a sip, and Yesef then touched his forehead with damp fingertips.
Water is the symbol of life. All living things need water to live. And so it is the symbol of the creator of life, Wist Aurin. Close your eyes.
Quentin then entered a dream. In the dream, Quentin still knelt upon a cool stone floor, but around him lay a bright meadow of limitless size. The lush green valley shimmered in honeyed light. The light itself seemed to emanate from no single source, but rather hung over the meadow like a golden mist. The air smelled of pine and the lighter fragrance of sweet grass. Overhead, the sky formed an arc of delicate blue iridescence, which fairly rippled with subtle shades of changing color, yet appeared always the same. No sun roamed the sky, but the heavens, as the whole of the valley, seemed charged with light. A crystal brook burbled close by. The water seemed alive as it splashed and danced along, sliding over the smooth round stones. An air of peace breathed over the scene, and Quentin felt a surge of joy spring up like a fountain inside him. His heart tugged within him as if struggling to break free and soar aloft on light wings of happiness.
Quentin, do you know me?
Quentin looked around somewhat fearfully. He saw no one nearby who might be speaking to him. He was utterly alone.
In the still of the night, you have heard my voice. And in the depths of your heart, you have sought my face. Though you searched for me in unholy temples, I cast you not aside.
Who are you? Tell me that I may know you.
I am the Maker, the One Most High. The gods themselves tremble in my presence. They are shadows. Faint mists tossed on the breeze and dispersed. I alone am worthy of your devotion.
As the voice spoke, Quentin realized he had heard it many times before, or so had longed to hear, in the dark of his temple cell when he cried out alone. He knew it, though he had never heard it this clearly, this distinctly before.
Oh, Most High, let your servant see you.
Instantly, the peaceful meadow was awash in a brilliant white light, and Quentin threw his arm across his face. When he again dared to peer beneath his arm, he saw the shimmering form of a man standing before him. The man stood tall with wide shoulders, rather young, but his features bore the stamp of a wise, seasoned leader. The man's form seemed to waver in Quentin's gaze, as if he were seeing a reflection in water. The man appeared solid enough, but his outline grew fuzzy at the edges, as if made of focused beams of living light, or clothed in an aura of rainbow-like luminescence. But his face held Quentin's attention. But the Man of Light's eyes gleamed like hot coals, and his face shined with the radiance of glowing bronze. Quentin could not remove his gaze from the dark, fathomless depths of the man's burning eyes. They held his in a sort of lover's embrace, strong yet gentle, commanding yet yielding. Hunger of a kind Quentin could not name burned out from those eyes, and Quentin felt afraid for presuming to exist within the sphere of the radiant being's sight.
Have no fear. Long have I had my hand on you and upheld you. Look on me and know in your heart that I am your friend.
Quentin did as he was bid and experienced a sudden rush of recognition, as if he had just met a close friend or a brother who had been long absent, his eyes filled with tears.
Please! I am not worthy.
My touch will cleanse you.
Quentin felt a warmth upon his forehead, where the man placed two fingertips. The shame vanished as the warmth spread throughout his body. He wanted to leap, to sing, to dance before the Man of Light who stood over him.
You seek a blessing. You have but to name it.
Quentin tried to make the words come, but they would not.
I know not how to ask for this blessing, though I know in my heart that I need it.
Then, we will ask your heart to reveal what lies within.
Quentin blinked in amazement, shocked by the intensity of his own feelings, for that was what it was, the raw, unspoken emotions wrenched from his heart.
Your heart is troubled about a great many things. You cry out for your friends. You fear what may happen to them if you are not with them. You seek the assurance of success in rescuing your king from the hold of the Evil One.
Quentin nodded dumbly. These were his feelings of the last few days.
But more than this, you seek higher things, wisdom and truth. You would know if there are true gods which men pray to who will hear their prayers.
It was true. All the long nights alone in his temple cell, the anguished cries of longing came back to him.
Quentin.
The Man of Light stretched out a broad, open hand to him.
My ways are wisdom, and my words are truth. Seek them, and your path will know no fear. Seek me, and you will find life. You ask a blessing. I will give you this. Your arm will be righteousness, and your hand, justice. Though you grow weary and walk in the darkness, fear nothing. I will be your strength and the light at your feet. I will be your comforter and guide. Forsake me not, and I will give you peace forever.
Quentin, looking deeply into the Man of Light's eyes, felt himself falling into the limitless void of time. As if through the dark reaches of starless night, he saw not through his own eyes, but through the eyes of the god, the orderly march of the ages, time stretching out past and future in front of him in an unbroken line. Then he saw a man he seemed to recognize, a knight. He was arrayed for battle, and his armor blazed as if made from a single diamond. He carried a sword which burned with a hungry flame, and a shield which shone with a cool radiance, scattering light like a prism. The knight raised his sword, and the darkness retreated before him. Then the knight flung the sword into the air, where it spun, throwing off tongues of fire which filled the sky. When the knight turned again, Quentin recognized with a shock that the knight was himself. Older and stronger, but himself.
I am Lord of all, maker of all things.
Then the vision faded, and Quentin was once again staring into the Man of Light's eyes. But now he knew them to be the eyes of the god himself, whose voice he had heard in the night, who had called him by name.
Quentin, will you follow me?
Quentin, bursting with contending emotions, threw himself at the Man of Light's feet and touched them with his hands. A current of living energy flowed through him, and he felt stronger, wiser, more sure than ever before in his life. He felt as if he had touched the source of life itself.
I will follow.
Then rise. You have received your blessing.
When Quentin came to himself, he was lying on his side in the dark. A single candle burned in its shallow bowl. Before him, the fountain splashed. Quentin raised his head to look around and saw that he was alone. As he got up to leave the inner room, he noticed that his right arm and hand tingled with a peculiar prickly sensation, both hot and cold at the same time. He paused to rub them, and then went out. The rain fell in a miserable drizzle from a low, gray, unhappy sky. The track underfoot had become a muddy rivulet, which trickled slowly as it wound its way down the hill among the giant forest evergreens. Quentin, astride Balder, and Tolly, mounted on a black and white pony, left behind by the others, slid uncertainly down the trail in a muffled silence, which hung on them like the heavy hooded cloaks they wrapped themselves in to keep out the rain. The trail from Dekra to the east was a much improved version of the boggy maze which they had floundered through on their way to the ruined city. So Quentin let Balder have his head and allowed his mind to wander where it would. He thought again of their leave-taking from Yesef, Melina, and the others. A sad parting it was, for in the short time he had been with them, he had grown very fond of them. They had said a few brief words of farewell. The Kuratok do not believe in lengthy goodbyes, since they consider that all those who serve the god will one day be reunited to live forever together. And as the horses stamped the ground impatiently, Quentin embraced Melina and hugged Yesef a little clumsily.
Come back, Quentin, when your quest is at an end. I would welcome a pupil like you.
I will come back when I can. I am grateful for all I've received of your kindness.
The god goes with you both.
Melina turned her face away, and Quentin saw the sparkle of a tear in the corner of her eye. He looked on them for a lingering moment, and then wheeled the big warhorse around and started down the path into the forest. He looked long over his shoulder, etching the memory deep into his mind. He wanted to remember it always as it appeared then, the sun filling the sky with a joyous light, the high bright sky scrubbed clean by white clouds, the red stone walls of the city rising gracefully into the heady spring air, his friends standing at the wide open gates, waving them away, until at last the slope of the hill cut them off from view. Quentin had never experienced a more emotional departure. But then, he reflected, he had never known anything but the coldness of the temple priests, who never greeted, nor bade farewell. Inside, Quentin tingled with excitement. His heart soared like a bird freed at last from a long captivity. He quickly forgot his melancholy of leaving in the overflowing good spirits he felt at being alive, being back on the trail, and at reliving again the vision of the night before. He had found it extremely difficult to sleep at all the last night. After the feast in his honor, where there was more singing and dancing and games, which lasted long into the night, he and Tolly had returned to Melina's rooms in the palatial governor's home. He had told them of the vision. Yesef and some of the other elders who had also gathered there listened intently, nodding and pulling their beards.
Your vision is a powerful sign. You are favored by the god. He has special plans for you.
The blessing of the Araga is itself a thing of power, for it carries with it the ability to accomplish its own end. The Most High God grants to every pure heart a blessing in kind, and the strength to carry out his purpose. In so doing so, you shall find your own happiness and fulfillment.
Then, what does my vision mean?
That is for you to discover. The god may show you in his own time, but most often the knowledge only comes with struggle. You must work out the meaning for yourself, for the interpretation comes in the doing.
This is indeed different from the ways of the old gods. In the temple, the people come to the priest for an oracle. The priest takes the offering and seeks an oracle or an omen on behalf of the pilgrim. He then explains the meaning of the oracle.
That is because the oracles are but foolishness of blind men. The smoke without the fire.
That night, when the guests had departed and he was alone in his bed, Quentin had prayed for the first time to this new god, the one he had met in his vision. The vision seemed still more real to him than the vague dimensions of his own dark room and comfortable bed.
Lead me in the discovery of your ways, God Most High. Give me the strength to serve you.
That was all he could think of to say. After all the formalized prayers of the temple, written down to be memorized by constant repetition, Quentin's simple prayer seemed to him ridiculously inadequate. But trusting in Yesef's observation that the god regarded more the state of the heart than the length of the prayer, Quentin let it go at that, and he had the strong inner conviction that his prayer had been heard, and by someone very close. Early that morning, before the sun peeped above the undulating horizon, Quentin and Toli had discussed their plans.
It is my desire to follow Thedo and the others, perhaps catch up to them if I can.
Toli looked at him with strange eyes, which Quentin found unsettling.
Why do you look at me so?
You have changed, Kenta.
Kenta was the Jer word for eagle, and by extension seemed to mean friend, master, lord, all at the same time. It was also the closest approximation of Quentin's own name which Toli would attempt, though to Quentin it seemed his friend did not try very hard. Toli fastened on this word for his own reasons.
How have I changed? I'm the same as I always was.
Toli saw it differently. He had watched the ceremony of the blessing with great admiration and respect. It had appeared to him as the coronation of a king, and he was proud that his master, for so he considered Quentin irrevocably now, had acceded to such a high honor.
No, you are not the same.
That was all he would say on the subject. So Quentin pushed on to other things. They would ride on to Tuck and then to Bestu, as the others had done, so Melina had informed them. All Quentin knew was that Nimrud could be found at Karsh, though where that might be he could not say. Melina refused to speak of the place, saying that it was an evil island, not nearly far enough away, though it'd be halfway round the world. So they had struck out upon the trail to Tuck, a much forsaken path through the northern forests which were home to the great numbers of red deer and wild pigs. The animals themselves kept the trail open, giving it the little use that it received. The Kuratok had no need of it. The second day out, Toli had awakened Quentin to a dismal dawn. Shortly after they had breakfasted on some of Melina's specially packed provisions, the rumbling clouds had begun to leak a fine mist of rain. The men had thrown on their hooded cloaks and proceeded in a subdued and melancholy mood. The soaring high spirits of the day before were dampened in the cheerless rain. As they rode along, Quentin became restive, his mind made uneasy by a thought which jabbed stubbornly at his conscience. He resolved to mention it to Toli at first opportunity. So when they stopped by a small running stream to water the horses, Quentin spoke what was on his mind.
Toli, do you know what is ahead of us?
The young Jer squinted up his eyes and peered down the darkened trail.
No. How can one know what lays ahead? Even well-known paths may change. The careful hunter goes with caution.
No. I mean something else. We go to find Thedo and Derwin and the others. Most likely we ride into great danger.
He watched Toli's face for any sign of concern. There was none. Quentin glanced down into the racing stream at his horse's muzzle sunk deep in the swirling water.
I have no right to ask you to accompany me any further. Your people sent you as a guide out of friendship. Now that we have reached Dekra and indeed left it behind, your task is ended. You are free to return to your people.
Quentin glanced up to see Toli's bronzed features drawn into deep lines of sorrow. His mouth turned down sharply at the edges. His dark brown eyes had grown cold.
If that is what you wish, Kenta, I will return to my people.
What I want? That does not matter. But you must go back. This is my journey, not yours. You did not ask for it. I cannot ask you to risk your life. You have no place in this fight.
You must tell me what you wish me to do.
I cannot. Do you see?
Toli did not see. He blinked back at Quentin gravely, as if to reproach him for cruelty unimaginable.
You may be killed.
Quentin's knowledge of the Jair speech was quickly becoming exhausted under the strain of trying to communicate his dilemma.
I cannot be responsible for your life if you follow me.
The Jair believe that every man is responsible for his own life. The Jair are free. I am free. We do not suffer any to be masters over us. But a Jair may take a master if he chooses. For a Jair to take a master, to serve him in all to the death, this is the highest honor. For to serve a worthy master accounts the servant worthy. Few of my people ever find an opportunity as I have found. A great master makes his servant great.
But the danger...
He who serves shares his master's portion. Danger, death, or triumph. If the master receives honor, so his servant receives much greater honor.
But I did not ask you to be my servant.
No, I chose you.
What about your people?
They will know and rejoice for me.
I do not understand.
That is because your people are brought up to believe that serving another is a weakness. It is not out of weakness that one serves, but out of strength.
I would still feel better if I could ask you myself.
Ask then, but I have already given my answer.
Is there no getting rid of you then?
The joke escaped Toli, whose face fell again momentarily.
To be dismissed as a servant is a great humiliation and disgrace.
A worthy master would not dismiss lightly one who esteems him so highly. But maybe I should serve you.
No. Some are born to be masters, but a servant must be taught quite young. It is better that I serve you. You, my master, wear the look of glory. You will I serve, for only by your side will I find glory too.
Very well. Since I would really rather not go alone, and you are determined not to allow me in any other case, we will go together.
As you wish.
My wishes seem to have nothing to do with it. To talk, then.
Quentin's heart was much lighter, and his mind at ease. He had not wanted to give up Toli's company. This master and servant situation, however, would require some getting used to. He had not known the extent of Toli's loyalty toward him, and wondered if he were at all capable of being a good master. Already the responsibility weighed heavier than he would have supposed. They rode along together through a wet afternoon and stopped to spend a soggy evening along the trail under the skimpy shelter afforded by a long-limbed evergreen whose branches brushed the ground. Toli tethered the horses and allowed them to walk a short pace to graze on nearby clumps of grass and forest foliage. Quentin unrolled the packs under the evergreen boughs and made a dry, soft bed by piling up the aromatic needles. Toli gathered dry bark and stones, and soon had a small fire going to warm them and dry out their sopping clothing. Night fell quickly in the forest, and the two lay in the dark. Quentin stretched himself upon his bedroll and breathed the fragrant balsam deep into his lungs.
What do you think of the new god?
In all the time they had spent at Dekra, he had not spoken to Toli about any of the Auriga religion. Now, that oversight embarrassed him.
He is not new. The Jair have always known him.
I did not know. What do you call him?
Winnowek.
Winnowek. I like that very much. What does it mean?
You would say it means father. Father of life.
The Dragon King Trilogy, In the Hall of the Dragon King Part 1, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2007, Stephen Lawhead. Published by arrangement with Thomas Nelson Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011 by The Cutting Corporation Incorporated. All rights reserved. With performances by Drew Kopis, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Joe Brack, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Yasmin Twazon, Karen Novak, Elizabeth Jernigan, James Konacek, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, Johan Detweiler, and Michael John Casey. Adapted and directed by Johan Detweiler. Produced by Richard Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed the Dragon King trilogy, be sure to look for R.A. Salvatore's Demon War Saga and Brent Weitz's Night Angel trilogy. Available now in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for exciting previews of other graphic audio material.
Yeah, this son of a bitch is guilty. You know it, and I say, let's hang the bastard.
Yeah! All right, it's now time to poll the jury. Jury, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty!
Well, yeah, so say you won, so say you all.
Yeah, that's what we all say.
Mr. Matt Jensen, you have been found guilty of murder and are sentenced to hang.
On his way to Yuma to hang for a crime he didn't commit, Matt Jensen will be involved in the worst train wreck in Arizona history.
How's it coming?
We pulled out a couple of the spikes, but they're damn hard to remove.
They're supposed to be hard to get out. All you have to do is pull up enough of them to be able to push the rail out a few inches.
You sure that'll stop the train?
You ever seen a train run on dirt?
Now Matt will stop at nothing to bring the men responsible for killing so many innocent people to the only justice he knows. The justice of the gun.
It's you! You son of a bitch! I'm gonna gut you like a hog!
Like an avenging angel, Matt Jensen will deliver the villains unto the hands of the devil. In Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man number 3, Purgatory.
I'll see you in hell!
Not likely. I've done my time in purgatory.
Available now in graphic audio.
You men are aware you're trespassing on private property, aren't you?
What is your name, boy?
My name's Cal. What's yours?
Lazarus. Lazarus Cain. Have you been saved, Cal?
Saved from what?
Why, from hell and damnation, of course.
What's all this got to do with the fact you men are stealing my boss's cattle?
Now hold on, boys. I can handle this young pup alone.
The Lord giveth, and he taketh away, my good boy.
When Smoke Jensen's friend and ranch hand is brutally shot while protecting his ranch, there isn't a demon in hell that could still Smoke Jensen's vengeful, bloody hands.
Did you find any papers on the man Cal described?
About the nearest one I saw was a man named Lazarus Kane. He and his gang did some raiding down in Arkansas recently, but there was no mention of his heading this way.
Well, if this Kane has decided to pay us a visit and did this to Cal, he's gonna wish he never left Arkansas.
Don't miss Smoke Jensen's bloody quest for revenge in Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man number 24. Guns of the Mountain Man.
You're no match for me, Jensen! I'll kill you before you can clear leather!
You reach for them guns, and one of us is gonna die.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.